Thanks for joining us. My name is Ibrahim Sani. The idea of exploring the kind of intersection that is currently happening between the worlds of geopolitics as well as technology and climate change is actually very, very important for us to discuss. This is because the world is changing at a faster rate than expected from the geopolitical tensions that started last year, I suppose, and is continuing on this year. Climate change is accelerating. Technology adoption is very, very important for us to explore as well. Here to look into all this is none other than the very astute gentleman, the distinguished fellow of the Institute of Capital Markets Research, Tan Sri Andrew Sheng. Tan Sri, you've had a very long, storied history when it comes to the corporate world, capital markets, banking industry, and perhaps finance in general. And we need to understand a little bit better in terms of how do we approach the kind of strategic thinking that is needed from the tripartite triple crisis of COVID-19, the recession, as well as climate change. Are we living in dangerous times right now, Tan Sri? Do you feel that there is a need for us to really look into this deeper and more aggressive moving forward?
Absolutely. I think I just share this with you. I've always been a, you know, finance guy. I started being an accountant, then I became a central banker, then I went to the World Bank to become a development banker, and then I worked in capital markets, you know, at Hong Kong, looking after the capital markets of Hong Kong, but also chairman of the IOSCO Technical Committee, which is the Global Standards Committee for Securities Markets. But in 2009, I became to realize that climate change was actually a serious issue, which was never in my radar screen because all I read was about finance. Mm. So what has finance got to do with climate
change? Yeah.
And the answer is, well, if you don't, you know, why do we have climate change? It's because we actually consume. Human consumption is destroying our planet. Every time we use 1 liter of gas, you know, petrol, we actually pump something like, you know, 3 pounds of carbon into the air, right? Every consumption, every time we enjoy any food or anything, drive a car or use anything, we're using iron, we're using copper, we're eating food and plants. So it's excessive consumption that drives excessive climate change. But where did the excessive consumption come from? Excessive debt. The more we print money, you know, you can only consume the future if you borrow from the future. Mm. And that's finance, basically, right? So all of a sudden I woke up, I realized, my goodness, finance is absolutely related to climate change. Now, technology is very good, but every time we invent technology, it runs on electricity. Where does the electricity come from? Coal-fired machines, you know, or solar energy. But people don't realize that even a wind turbine uses 5 tons of copper.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I didn't.
So if we carry on using wind turbines, the world will run out of copper. Mm. So everything is interrelated. You know, the technology, the demand for resources, the consumption, you know, which is destroying, as we're just now talking, destroying our beautiful, pristine marine reefs. Mm. I just came back from Sabah looking at the jungle, and obviously that is also being destroyed by climate change, right? I mean, because of the viruses that is spreading around, the indigenous people there, the Orang Murut, has difficulty even finding, you know, wild animals to hunt. Mm. So all these, you know, and then with the palm oil development that's going there, the river water is now so full of fertilizers and pesticides that it's no longer safe for individuals to drink.
Yeah.
The global financial system has been on a rethink since 2008 financial crisis.
Oh.
Because that's, you know, I lived through the Asian financial crisis, 97, 98, where Malaysia, you know, was deeply affected, right? And successfully came out of it. But in the 2008 one, which was in fact a repeat of the Asian financial crisis, except on a global scale, or more precisely, on the advanced country scale, suddenly the advanced country woke up to the fact that not only do they owe the emerging markets, the poorer countries are actually lending money to the advanced markets. Okay, but secondly, they also invented quantitative easing, which is central banks printing money. And all of a sudden, the whole concept of finance, you know, climate change, technology has changed since 2008. Think about it. Before 2008, there was no blockchain. Okay, and today, blockchain is the trust engine.
Yeah.
Well, some of you call it the scam engine, right? Because it's not who certifies is all blockchain, right? It's not clear on that issue. You know, secondly, the finance has continued to grow. You know, since 2008, debt in the world has now increased to 4 times world GDP, debt alone. All right. And that's because, you know, governments have borrowed from the future. Corporates are borrowing, right? Household debt is very large for many countries because just borrowing to buy houses, houses are much more expensive because of monetary printing. So inflation has gone up. So all these are all related, and the more and the developing countries want to grow, and now the richer countries saying, no, you know, you are now producing carbon.
Yeah.
But the poorer countries tell the rich countries, you damage the climate, you damage the planet, and now you tell me to stop.
Yeah.
But I want to grow like you.
Yeah.
So we've got a conflict going on. And this conflict is actually so complicated that it may actually extend to war amongst the bigger powers. Now, for smaller countries like Malaysia, you know, if the big powers are not willing to put money on the table to help us deal with climate change, the latest estimate it will cost about $3 to $4 trillion a year to reinvest in a sustainable infrastructure, right? Okay, but at the moment, the richer countries are having difficulty even providing $100 billion for the poorer countries to deal with climate change. What's $100 billion?
Yeah,
that's the amount of money that is being spent on the war in Ukraine at the moment, annually. So all these are interrelated. If we don't raise the funds to help the poorer countries, and especially the poorer economies, deal with climate change, we will all suffer.
Right? Do you feel that there are multiple proxy wars that are currently taking place right now? Say, for instance, the Silicon War between China and the US, Ukraine being a proxy war between the West and Russia. There's so many proxy wars that are currently taking place. Nobody's focusing on the real issue, which is climate change.
Exactly. That's why I feel that, you know, at the global level, the big powers will be involved in big power conflict, rivalry, some of which may lead to existential nuclear war. Small countries like Malaysia is not in that game. Our game should be, how do we deal with climate change for ourselves and actually show the world how we can be leaders in the transition of green finance and inclusive finance, right? So let me give an illustration. As you know, in that regard, as a former securities market regulator, I say mea culpa, because stock markets, you know, we all want stock markets to grow, but there are only 55,000 listed companies in the whole world, but there are probably 500 million small and medium micro enterprises that can't get public listing or finance from the public. So obviously, how do we use the capital markets to help small people help themselves to deal with climate change and uplift their incomes at the same time?
You're trying to talk about empowering, say, for instance, 90% of commercial enterprises in the world.
Not just commercial enterprises, social enterprises.
Okay.
Social enterprises. You see, again, this has come the free market idea. Oh, you know, you must do this for profit. But if we do this only for profit, we will destroy our environment.
That's right.
So therefore, social enterprise,
are, in fact, most mom and pop shops
are social enterprises.
Are social enterprises.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, if you really think about it, selling nasi lemak, you know, is in fact a social enterprise, because all they're doing is not for profit, it is to feed the family.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
So to my, in my view, how do we transform the stock market to help social enterprises must be the wave of the future.
Let's get to the brass and tacks. How do we help?
How do we do this? Yeah. Well, the, our Indian friends in India has now started on this. Last year in July, they did the consultations for a social equity market, social stock market. What does it mean? It means that they are going to have an exchange for social enterprises. What do you mean by a social enterprise? Any enterprise, that means an NGO or a community, who are able to have a project that will be raised money in this social stock market. But what are they trading in the social stock market? The answer is a zero coupon, you know, no return instrument. What the instrument does, just to give you a simple illustration, at the moment, if I...
What would be the interest of the investor if I get zero coupon?
The whole idea is, at the moment, if you buy a stock of any of the bursa, you might not make money, right? Yeah. If you don't make money, it's a zero, no return, right?
Yeah.
In most cases, a lot of the small companies, you have no dividend.
Yeah.
So why don't we transform it? Instead of saying, you must deliver profits, why don't you have a social impact audit? That means, if I tell in my social enterprise, I say in this kampung, I will deliver within the next 3 years the quality of life, better bridge, better education, change in the income levels over the next 3 years, your money you give me, I will use it on this specific kampung. That's zakat, right? I mean, in that sense.
It is. It is.
Correct?
It is.
Now, so that's why I feel, you know, the social stock market is actually Islamic finance, because Islamic finance is not about using the usury, using interest rate. Mm. It is using return and helping the poorer people. Mm-hmm. Well, today, you know, in India, they use actually qualified firms of auditors, right? Mm. And if
not just in India, but everywhere. Yeah.
No. But it's not just in India. But what I'm saying is that in India, they're using these qualified firms of auditors, which exist in Malaysia, to also do social audits. Hmm. And all you need is the standard. So, for example, today, under the accounting standards, IFRS, International Financial Reporting Standards, a new standard has come out. It's called International Sustainability Standards. Right? Sustainability standards. Now, this has only just come out, right? So if you have these IS, this is done by the International Sustainability Standards Board, ISSB, with these standards, which has only started 2021, this auditor could actually also audit that that project fulfills these standards. In the same way, for example, you already have firms who actually says, well, if you want to capture carbon, I will certify that over this last year, you captured how many tons of carbon in your enterprise.
Yeah.
Right? So all these are now available. So
I based on my conversation with HSBC Amana per se, they have taken stock into the International Sustainability Standards Board under IFRS.
That's right.
And they have... I should say persuade some of their debtors to actually take on these kind of standards, and they are trying to see how they can reduce their cost, the cost of capital to their borrowers, to a point where it is beneficial for their clients to take on sustainable practices in order for them to lower their cost of capital.
Exactly.
Now, I don't know how far and long they have been in terms of trying to make this work.
Okay, so let me give you an illustration, right? Today, all companies are supposed to meet ESG standards. Environmental,
lip service, social, Tansri, unfortunately.
I agree with you. But now we can use that lip service to become, you know, walking the talk. Mm. What do I mean by that? Mm. Suppose we have in Malaysia now this social stock exchange. Suppose we have now 100,000, just for argument's sake, 100,000 social enterprises out there, right, who are now being audited. And these doesn't have to be very large sums. Suppose it takes 50,000 to build a small, you know, improve the water supply in a distant kampong.
Mm-hmm.
And the auditor is able to say that this social enterprise has built this bridge for 50,000 ringgit. Won't it be possible for a listed company to say, I will contribute to this project, I will adopt this kampong, right, and provide $50,000 ringgit a year for building the bridge, improving the water? And that is their social corporate responsibility, right? CSR.
Where do you feel the pain point in terms of creating the social stock exchange exist? You've been a regulator for the longest of time. When you were at the advising CIMB Group as the international advisory board, if I'm not mistaken, the name was, I was just a rank and file staff there in CIMB, and I remember you were talking about how regulators need to actually embrace change. However, that was a bit of a oxymoron, because regulators regulate, they don't normally adopt change. You're asking regulators to be different, but by nature they shouldn't be, right?
Well, okay. Regulators suffer from two things. First of all, this is true of all regulators, okay, including advanced country regulators.
Okay. Okay.
But let me put it this way, in emerging markets. We in emerging markets suffer from the first problem is that the standards are set by the West.
Mm.
So if what the West is best,
mm,
and then we say how to become best, 208 came and said the best is having problems, but we don't have their problems.
Yeah.
Obviously, the rest is better than the West in these regards, because the West failed. The rest did not, right? The global financial crisis happened in the West,
yeah,
right? The advanced markets.
Yeah.
So suddenly, we have now a confidence that we need to find our own standards.
Okay, we're talking about two things.
There's two things.
Yeah.
The second one is, how do we now say that if what we have adopted for the last 50 years, you know, 60 years since independence, right, 70 years since independence, how do we, if that has not worked that well, how do we change our mindset? And changing a mindset is very difficult. Because, you know, if you give a carpenter a hammer, he sees every problem as a nail. But suddenly you tell the carpenter, look, not everything can be nailed. You might need a spade. You know, you might need a yeah, screwdriver, right?
Yeah.
You know, you have to think about the ecosystem.
Let's talk a little bit more about the Georgetown Institute for Open and Advanced Studies. What do you guys do there?
Well, the you know, it's a grand name for a very, very modest ambition.
It's a very long name.
It's too long.
And the acronym is not catchy. It's GIOS.
GIOS.
GIOS. Yeah. Okay.
I actually wanted to be GIOS. You know,
G-I-O-S.
Georgetown Institute of Open Studies.
Yeah, I mean, that's better, right?
That's right. But what my friend said, no, we should be called advanced. Well,
okay.
I'm not, you know, going to you know, sort of fight that issue. We're part of Wawasan Open University. And Wawasan Open is an online, you know, sort of,
yeah, of course,
adult education university.
OUM, yeah.
JAWS is basically a platform for us to invite global experts to come to Georgetown, right? Georgetown is a global name because,
mm-hmm,
you know, unlike Georgetown University, which, mm-hmm, is one word, Georgetown is just two words. So, mm-hmm, we're not plagiarizing. There is a Georgetown, you know,
in Penang.
Yeah, in Penang, right? Which happened because, you know, it was this. I mean, I don't like use the word the colonial discovery discovered, you know, but it was named after King George,
yeah,
right, under the colonial period.
Yeah, yeah.
But having kind of inherited that name, and it has global recognition, you know, we use Georgetown, you know, Institute of Open and Advanced Studies,
mm-hmm,
to be able to attract foreigners to come.
Mm.
And meet with local academics, mm-hmm, and policy makers, mm-hmm, to discuss. So, you know, about 2 weeks ago, we had this conference on climate change. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea was to discuss, I mean, let's do a stock take of what's happening in climate change. And then the second one is, what can we do in Malaysia, mm-hmm. okay, to use this not as a cost, but as an opportunity. Mm. And so, for example, one idea that came up, clearly, immediately after the conference, I took some of the international advisors to Sabah, where I come from, you know, to go back to the kampung to go and see what the real life challenges are, yeah. on the ground. So it's very easy to talk about it conceptually,
yeah.
and in principles,
yeah.
but when you go down to the ground, you find these real tough issues,
yeah.
you know, that these kampung,
yeah.
Face. And that's why you need an open mind, because, you know, essentially the issue is, if for the last 50, 60 years, we have not managed to uplift these kampung to the national average, can we rethink the game?
Mm.
And I think, you know, I was very pleased to meet the Sabah Tourism Board, where they have what they call community-based ecotourism.
Mm-hmm.
That means they encourage, you know, visitors from abroad or even locally to go back to the kampung.
Mm-hmm.
And when they have a homestay, they live with the kampung, they come to see the jungle, see the river, see our natural beauty, live with the indigenous people. They, the visitors have a better understanding of nature. And then every ringgit they spend is money in the kampung.
And also basically showing what is at stake, I presume.
Absolutely.
This is what's costing
Absolutely.
Us. Just like my coral scuba diving
Absolutely.
Moment.
Absolutely.
You know, talking about it conceptually, you know, I have guests coming in every day talking about climate change,
exactly.
climate change. And then I put on my goggles and I go down and it's bleached.
Exactly.
No fish.
Exactly.
No clownfish, no
exactly.
nothing.
Exactly. So if we were talking about ecotourism, will the foreigner coming 10,000 kilometers away come to look at palm oil? You see, you're laughing already, right? You're laughing already.
Yeah.
They're not going to look at palm oil. They want to see pristine trees that goes 150 tall up,
yeah.
with, you know, sort of orangutan,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
or the hornbill,
yeah.
you know, Rafflesia plants,
yeah.
you know, monkey cups and things like that. They want to see what is unique. So we come back to what, you know, the Harvard strategist, you know, on business strategist says. Competitive advantage is not about what everybody's got, it's what unique to you.
Mm.
So the question then for Malaysia and Sabah is, what is unique to us? And my goodness, it's so obvious. We have perfect timing in the sense the time and tide is with Malaysia.
Mm.
The big boys are fighting. We are in the neutral ASEAN zone.
Mm.
The timing is good. The geography is good. We are located in the fastest growing zone in the world.
On the planet, yeah.
Think about Malaysia as a community of smart kampung. What is smart kampung? Kampung pintar really means how do we use technology and global knowledge for local upliftment and restoring the environment, right? The common, you know, corporate view is smart cities. Smart cities mean big infrastructure,
yeah.
you know, urban infrastructure,
yeah.
urban Israel. When I was working in Bank Negara, working at, you know, economic development, it became very clear to me. You spend money in the city, the money leaks abroad because I want to buy a Porsche. I want to just spend money,
yeah.
you know, I want to fly on holiday in London,
whatever, yeah.
right? But you spend money, the government or the private sector spend money in the kampung, the money will go back to the city.
Mm.
And therefore, what benefits the kampung will benefit the city,
mm.
not just benefit the city. So we really need to rethink our game.
Are
right?
we too late, Tanshi?
No. No. This is exactly it. Nothing is too late.
2 degrees Celsius already.
I agree. I can't help, you know, the world as such, but I individually, we all are responsible for our community, right? For our state, for our nation, okay? That part we have some control over.
Mm.
So let's now work together to help, you know, transform our villages so that they see upliftment in not their income, the quality of life, and also the environment, save the environment, preserve our reefs, protect our jungles, right? And at the same time, lift up their incomes. That's the secret. Now, if we do this, you just think about it, right? Our pristine jungles, what we have left, is still better than that. What's happening in Amazon, as you know, yeah. In Brazil has the biggest problem because the last 5-6 years, or yes. maybe they
had a crazy
severe
guy.
Problem, right? Yeah. So what I see, what the Sapa government is doing, is trying to, rethink the whole strategy. Is very encouraging to me.
What about the current political system, the political risks that exist, administration-wise, changing of chief ministers in Sabah, changing of prime ministers in Malaysia?
Please accept, we're not trying to change the politics. We're going to just change the way they think about the development in how you look at climate change as an opportunity rather than a burden. Mm. Okay? What is the Malaysian, sort of motto? It is diversity, right? It is, the nation is diverse and we have unity through diversity. Mm. But it is through that diversity that actually we find different ways of growing. So different states will have different strategies and on how they develop.
That's fine.
Right? Yep. And what is the biggest natural advantage of Sabah and Sarawak? And the answer must be their huge natural resources, very diverse population and cultures and languages, right? And it's that diversity where we will find different opportunities for growth and lifting up their opportunities to change, right? So for example, if we ask the Kampong to focus on rubber, that, in a sense, because the rubber price have been flat for the last 10 years, are condemning them to poverty. Mm. Whereas if they are able to plant durian, the tarap tree, manggis, all these different types of high value crops, you bring them up. And if they use organic fertilizers, and use replanting cycles, multi-cropping, they actually are totally environmentally protective.
And sustainable. Yeah.
And then
self-reliant as well.
Self-reliant, that's exactly it. What we are now asking for is resilience, adaptability, flexibility, open to change.
Empowered by finance and empowered
by the people.
Thank you very much.
We will help our people help ourselves.
As always, Tan Sri, it's always a pleasure and a privilege speaking to you. That was Tan Sri Andrew Sheng, the chairman of the Georgetown Institute of Open and Advanced Studies. Do find out more about what they do. There are plenty of reports and research studies that can be found there. He's also the Distinguished Fellow of the Institute of Capital Markets Research. Tan Sri Andrew Sheng, thank you very much for coming on the show. My name is Ibrahim Sani. Catch you in the next one.